So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life when the words all come down.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
I'm Joe.
Wow, it's Joe.
I am not Burt Bacharach's personal assistant, Waylon.
Oh, okay.
I'm not.
You're
I'm
not
Joe.
Him. Okay, yeah. Good. Well,
you like that?
This is
like the little twist.
I do. That was great.
The last episode of our season.
So this is the podcast that brings you nostalgic, interesting, and crazy events in American pop culture history.
Yeah.
Year by year.
Yeah.
That's right.
And some jokes.
And some.
I'll say some silly things once in a while.
Ridiculousness. So, what we are in is the second half of 1989.
Yes, and this is the last episode of season two.
Oh my God.
This is our...
The 80s have been a wild ride.
Yeah, this is our 27th episode.
Mm-hmm.
We started somewhere in the beginning of the season, we started doing two episodes per year. That's why it's kind of an odd number to end on, and we don't really care.
Yep.
But it's, so this is the end of the 80s.
Yes.
And so... Just for you listeners, note, don't think we're going away.
Nope, because guess what's coming?
Well, we've already done the 90s. We stumbled through the 90s. If you go back, if those of you who've been with us from the beginning, you've clearly seen an improvement. The 90s, we weren't very good.
No.
But we're not now that we're finishing the 80s, it doesn't mean we're going back into the 90s and doing that again. Next season is...
Waka chicka, waka chicka, waka chicka,
the 70s. You may have just heard the intro to next season. It might be just...
No, it won't be that.
Wow. Reading, judge your mind.
I'm excited. I can't wait. I love the 70s.
Yeah, you love the 70s. There's probably tons of crazy murders. I think it'll be cooler.
Well, it was the decade of the serial killer, for one thing.
Well, and there'll be so many things we probably never heard about.
Right.
Again, the farther we go back, the more things didn't go viral because not everybody had the internet.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Nobody, I mean, we weren't alive really. I mean, we were alive a little bit. We were tiny.
I was... Yeah, 72 I was born. So.
Yeah, I wasn't even born until the second half of next season.
That's so. Right, next season.
But, I mean, people read newspapers. Nobody even read, people read newspapers, but everybody, it should be exciting. There should be a lot of stuff, but there's a lot more research we got to do, too. So we'll
tonight, we're going to talk about 1989 starting in June. If you haven't listened to the first half of the year, be sure to check that out.
Go look at the last episode where we left off with the NBA championship series ended. And we had a new champion. I don't know if you remember the previous episode. We talked about the Lakers, remember? The Lakers and the Pistons. I kind of hinted that the Pistons were starting to form the Bad Boys, kind of.
I don't know.
Well, this is when the Bad Boys took over. Bill Laimbeer was known. He's a big, dumb white guy that was known for, beating the crap out of people on the court.
Anyway, beating people up?
Yeah, knocking guys out, getting fouled out and stuff.
Oh.
And then he hurt his face, and he had to wear this big, dumb plastic thing on his face. And he looked like an idiot, but... And everybody, the Beastie Boys hated Bill Laimbeer. But anyway, the Pistons won the series in a 4-game sweep, making the first time the Lakers had swept the first three rounds of the playoffs, only to be swept in the finals.
Okay.
As of today, the Pistons are the only recent Eastern Conference team to sweep in NBA Finals. Prior to 2016, the Pistons were the only team to clinch all four series on the road. So they had the rough play, Bill Laimbeer, I talked about that. They were the Bad Boys. And then after this series, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar announced his retirement.
Oh,
you want
to
guess how old he was?
Probably 33 or something.
42.
Yeah.
After 20 years in the NBA.
Wow. I wish I could retire at 42.
Yeah.
It would be nice.
And Pistons guard Joe Dumars was the MVP. Then on June 16th, 1989, Ghostbusters 2 came out.
Okay.
And that was the seventh top grossing movie that year.
I have no memory of Ghostbusters 2.
So the only thing I remember it for is Bobby Brown.
Okay.
Remember he sang that they had another Ghostbusters song. It wasn't the who you gonna call it. It was the In Control.
Oh, yeah, I do.
They call them Ghostbusters and the In Control. Too hot to handle, too cold to hold. They call them Ghostbusters and the In Control.
That's right.
Had a thrilling party with a bunch of children. All the wild slime was under the building. I won't do the rest.
No,
but
don't
remember,
do the rest.
Remember Bobby Brown was in the movie, too. He was a bellhop or something. And he had the Gumby hair.
I don't know if I've ever seen Ghostbusters 2.
Well, Viggo. Viggo's the bad guy. It's all about Vigo, the master of evil. Try to battle my boys. That's not illegal.
Okay.
So the only thing I have about it is that the role of Vigo, he's the bad guy, mm-hmm. was played by Wilhelm von Homburg.
Okay.
All of his lines were dubbed by Max von Sydow.
Oh, the guy from The Exorcist.
Is that who that is? I didn't know who that was.
Yeah, he was the old priest in The Exorcist.
Anyway, Wilhelm was unaware that he would be dubbed, and he left the premiere in anger. He didn't find out till the premiere.
Oh.
And so he left. He was all pissed off. Man. He left it off.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, man. I'd be pissed too. Mm-hmm. Probably me invited too. All his friends. Look, watch me in this movie. Great. And they said, oh, you couldn't even talk in it, jackass. Do you know who Wilhelm von Homburg is?
No, I do not. And I didn't see the movie.
This guy plays Vigo. So I think he's like a little guy or a little bad guy or something. All right. And mm-hmm. then Thursday, June 22nd, 1989. Mm-hmm. In a hearing before Judge Norbert A. Nedel on Pete Rose's request for a temporary restraining order, Dowd reveals evidence that shows Pete Rose bet on baseball, including Reds games, who he played for in 1985 and 1986 when he was a player manager, as well as in 1987. The New York Times reports the FBI has determined Rose's handwriting is on betting slips seized from Peters.
Oh, boom.
So that came out, and then it was like, oh, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
I remember people thinking, like, what's the big deal? Everybody gambles, blah, blah, blah. But this was like, he was not only a player, but a manager. So he could totally
fix the games.
But I think his argument, if I remember correctly, a lot of his arguments was, I was betting on the Reds.
Right.
I was betting on us to win.
Yeah, you can't fix the game.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to lose. I wasn't betting that we'd lose. I was betting that we'd win, and then I'd go try to win because I'm a real trier. And his name was always Charlie Hustle.
Yeah.
They call people like, people that run when you're just jogging, like, mm-hmm. we're just jogging around the lap. You don't need to sprint the whole thing. But Pete Rose is the guy they call Charlie Hustle because he's trying to beat everybody on just a warm-up lap kind of thing. You know, like, stop trying so hard, jackass, because in sports, you kind of just, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, we had a guy in football that we'd have to run conditioning. It's not a race. We're all just, we all have to run two laps at the end of the thing. And he always had to be first. And if he wasn't first, mm-hmm. he would have an injury and he'd fall down and be like, oh, crap, somebody beat him. And then he's like, oh, I got to, he wouldn't finish the running.
God.
Because he had an injury. It was like every time.
Yeah.
So he was a Charlie Hustle. So I kind of believe that he probably did think he was going to win and just was mm-hmm. betting on himself. But maybe not. We'll see. Maybe there's more news. I didn't read all this, so we'll see.
Okay.
So anyway, Pete Rose, big ugly dude. And then on the very next day, on Friday, June 23rd, 1989, mm-hmm. Batman, the number one grossing film of 1989, mm-hmm. Batman.
Yep. I was working in a movie theater when this came out.
Oh, were you?
Yep, 1989, the summer.
This is like the first big superhero.
That was the summer
movie,
I worked there. Yep.
Well, did you know who played Batman?
Michael Keaton.
You know who played the Joker, do you remember?
Yeah, it was Jack Nicholson.
Well, did you know that Robin Williams was offered the role of the Joker?
Oh, really?
When Jack Nicholson was hesitating, like he wasn't
He didn't
exactly
know if he
sure.
wanted to do it.
And Robin Williams even accepted the role. But when producers approached Nicholson again and told him Williams would take the part, if he didn't, Nicholson then took it.
Oh, boom.
And Robin Williams was released.
Oop.
Robin Williams resented being used as bait. And not only refused to play the Riddler in Batman Forever, but he also refused to be involved in any Warner Brothers productions until the studio apologized.
Did they ever?
I think they did, because I'm sure he did some later. Jack Nicholson received a percentage of the gross on the film due to its massive box office take.
Yeah.
He took home around $60 million.
Whoa.
As of 2003, it was still the single movie record of an actor's salary, but that's been 15 years,
yeah,
so who knows?
Good.
The website I got that from has not been updated since 2003, so.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy, though?
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's a lot of money. That's crazy. And he was the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Robin Williams.
I know.
He'd have been a great Joker.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
He's so silly and crazy. I mean, he'd have been a great Riddler.
Yeah, great Riddler.
I mean, he's so crazy and wacky. Like,
I guess the Joker is a whole new thing since Heath Ledger did it so brilliantly. Like, the Joker, to me, isn't
as silly. He's more evil. Just
like, he's
badass,
just
crazy. He's crazy scary.
Crazy.
Yeah, he would have been
scary.
He would have been more silly of a cartoon if Robin Williams did.
He totally would have been. Yeah. And I prefer the crazy, scary one.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just the most brilliant performance.
Yeah. I guess I remember it.
Oh, so good.
Heath Ledger's the guy from Brokeback Mountain?
Yeah.
Which one is he?
The blonde one?
The sexual lover one?
You're ridiculous.
I really don't remember Heath Ledger much. I remember that movie, but like, I wouldn't pick him out in a crowd.
Yeah. Well, he's dead now, so.
I know. Friday, that same day that Batman came out?
Yep.
Another movie came out, the number 5 overall grossing movie of 1989. Mm-hmm. You want to guess what it is?
No.
Rick Moranis is in it.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Yes, you guessed it.
Yeah, that's pretty much the biggest movie that he was in.
Except Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was in Ghostbusters.
Spaceballs.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah. I'm just thinking...
Little Shop of Horrors.
I'm thinking of 89.
Like everything he's done. Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking of in 89.
That's true. So, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. So, some other titles that they were going to call it before they named it that mm-hmm. was Grounded, The Big Backyard, and Teeny Weenies.
Those are all terrible titles.
Those were all working titles.
But then again, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids is kind of a dumb title, too.
Yep. The Society for the Preservation of English Language and Literature awarded Honey, I Shrunk the Kids with its 1989 Dunce Cap Award, citing the title's grammatical error of using the word shrunk instead of shrank.
Oh. Okay.
And you remember the scene when he's in the kid's in the giant thing of Cheerios?
Sort of.
The giant bowl of Cheerios yeah. he's in when he's about to eat them?
Yeah.
A tank was filled with 16,000 gallons of milk-like substance made from chlorinated water, food thickener, and pigment.
God.
The Cheerios were made from tractor inner tubes, 12 feet in diameter, coated in foam.
Making movies was such a fucking mess before computers, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Think about it. Somebody had to put all that shit together.
They didn't make all that crap. But somebody had to jump
away
into it.
And
then get rid of it and drain it out and throw it away somewhere.
And then you have to do it 85 times to get the same color or whatever the hell.
And now computers just make everything in a second.
I mean, think about all the shit they had to make. Physical things they had to make for all those kinds of movies.
All the time that saved,
think about,
too.
Like, Star Wars and stuff. Like, all the shit they had
all
to make.
All those miniatures they had to build and makeup and all that.
Yes, and even the sets and stuff. Like, they can CGI all of it now.
And it looks pretty real.
Yeah, it looks pretty damn real.
And now, instead, all that money made to do all that stuff just goes in some computer nerd's pocket.
Yeah, that's right.
Some geek just gets a whole
I
bunch of money.
I wish it was me.
Well, you are a geek.
I'm not
no,
a computer
I'm sorry,
geek, though.
It's not. Yeah, you're definitely not a computer geek.
No, I'm not.
You can barely right-click.
That is not true.
You're not very good at right-clicking.
That is not true.
You're just not much of a right-clicker. I'm sorry. That's how I judge people on there.
All right, what's
computer
next?
Savvy. Saturday, mm-hmm. June 24th, 1989, Richard Marx comes barreling back.
Oh,
we thought Richard Marx's career would be
gone.
Over. We were hoping Richard Marx's career was over, but no. He says, wait, I'm not done yet.
Yep.
I have another number one hit.
And
I'm still not over the fact that he kept Pour Some Sugar on Me from being the number one song.
Yeah,
remember when I said that?
Grudge against him for
that. Yeah, he kept that off. And that just goes to show, America doesn't always know what's best. We don't know what's best for us. Sometimes we pick Richard Marx over Def Leppard. And then years later, we look back and are like, whoa, Def Leppard was way better than Richard Marx. Richard Marx sucks.
And what's this song?
This time, Don't You Know? Don't You Know?
God.
Not gonna stop until we're
I gotta
satisfied.
Listen to you sing again and try to figure out what the hell the song is.
Satisfied? Like, I don't remember it. I just wrote myself a note that says, don't you know ooh? It was gonna help me remember it. But
I don't
know.
Don't
you know? It's a terrible song, so who cares?
I don't think you're singing it remotely correctly.
I'm singing it exactly right.
I don't think you are.
Never gonna stop until we're satisfied.
That doesn't sound like a song at all.
Shut up. I sing perfectly. In fact, I'm the best singer that ever lived.
You're a pretty bad singer.
I'm not that bad. I'm pretty good, actually. A lot of people tell me I should keep at it.
No, nobody tells you that. There's nobody saying that.
Yeah, there is.
No, there
isn't. People wake me up in the morning when I'm at work, sleeping under my desk.
Did you put that shirt on purpose?
What shirt on?
You got American Timelines.
Oh, I'm wearing an American Timelines shirt that is available on Amazon.com for $89.99.
It is not.
I know it's not available. Maybe it will be.
Richard Marx is so 80s. Oh.
I won't give up until I'm satisfied.
Don't you know?
I won't give up until I'm satisfied. Yeah, that's a terrible song. Well, not
Richard Marx.
Now I'll ask you in 20 minutes to remember this song.
And I won't.
You won't be able to. Because it's such a forgettable, awful song.
It
Richard
is.
Marx sucks. And he made the world worse.
Well, and he's just an emblem of the 80s.
He is. He's probably a really nice guy.
Richard Marx.
But he did make the world more crappy.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, think about
it. He did something physically to make the world crappier.
Just think about it. There are Richard Marx fans that are like, oh, my God, I wish Richard Marx put out more music.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have an opinion. They shouldn't get to vote.
No.
Richard Marx fans should not be allowed to vote.
No, you're right.
We should make that up. I want to write my congressman. And then on Friday, June 30th, Highway to Heaven was on.
Oh, yeah. I never watched that show.
Jonathan and Mark's latest assignment. I don't know which one's. But Jonathan is the guy with the big hair. Michael
I
Landon,
never saw it.
I well, think, probably.
No, Michael Landon was the angel.
I know. I think he's Jonathan. Because the other guy was a scummy bearded guy with an Oakland A's hat. Jonathan and Mark. He's probably Mark.
Mark, yeah.
Jonathan and Mark's latest assignment has them as private investigators, and their clients are a Vietnamese couple who have come to the U.S. to look for their sons, whom they had to give up during the war. Jonathan and Mark locate them, and the couple wants to bring them back to with them to Singapore. But the boys have a life in the U.S. now and have bonded with the couple who took them in.
All right.
I'm glad we know that. I think I brought that up because I think you have something on that date that I was going to say. Oh, Michael Landon.
On what date?
June 30th.
I don't have anything until August.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Why the hell do I look up Highway to Heaven?
I don't know, but that was a big, long conversation for that.
Saturday, July 1st, 1989. Richard Marx gets taken over by Milli Vanilli.
Oh.
Remember Milli Vanilli?
Yes, yes. I'm trying to think of the song.
Ba 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 ba,
oh,
baby.
Baby.
Don't forget my number.
So
ba,
bad.
Ba 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 ba, baby. You're changing your mind about my singing now.
No, that song is so bad.
I really did a lot of Milli Vanilli research because I totally forgot that they even existed.
You did?
I mean, I didn't. I remembered them right away, but
Remember
that whole thing?
Yeah.
That whole thing? So
they
some
didn't
of
even
that,
sing it?
A lot of that happened this year, so we'll get into some of that.
Yeah.
But I looked up Robin Fab's new album. Like, I know way more about Milli Vanilli than I need to know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that song was number one on July 1st. Before, at this point, nobody knew that they were fake. That they,
of course
they weren't
not.
The real singers.
Not when their songs were number one.
Yeah, not at this point. But the same year, it was all going to unravel. Yeah. Then Friday, July 7th, 1989, the third highest grossing movie came out. Do you know what that is? Third highest in 1989? Lethal Weapon 2.
Okay. I didn't see that.
You didn't?
Mm-mm. I don't think I've seen any of the Lethal Weapons.
Really?
Yeah.
During production of Lethal Weapon 2, Richard Donner was shocked when Mel Gibson confided that he was drinking 5 pints of beer for breakfast. Despite his alcohol problems, Gibson was known for his professionalism and punctuality.
And he's a psychopath.
He's drinking 5 pints of beer for breakfast.
Ugh. It'd be awful.
Now, back then, beer was like Budweiser, so you can drink a lot more than that than
I know, but
beer today.
But even still.
Just for breakfast?
You'd feel like shit all day.
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that?
Well, you can't help it.
No, I know, but I just mean, after 5 things of beer, I feel like awful.
Yeah, right.
So I can't imagine wanting to do that in the morning, right, getting ready for the day.
After 5 beers in St. Louis, you're the designated driver.
That's right. That's true.
And then on Saturday, July 8th of 1989, Fine Young Cannibals take over the Billboard number one spot.
She drives me crazy.
No, we did that already.
We did that one,
I think, last year or earlier.
That's the only one I know that they did.
Good Thing.
Oh, I do kind of remember that.
Good Thing.
Fine Young Cannibals is not very good.
They're not great. The song made its first appearance in the movie Tin Men in 1987. The Fine Young Cannibals portrayed a nightclub band in the movie performing this song and 3 others, including the song's B-sides, Social Security.
Okay.
That film is set in Baltimore in 1963, and the song's retro soul style is consistent with that setting.
Okay.
Do you care about that?
Nope.
Did you see the movie Tin Men?
No.
That doesn't sound familiar to me either.
Mm-mm.
And then on Monday, July 10th.
Yeah.
That's my birthday of 1989. It's my 13th birthday. When he died in 1980, Mel Blanc died on my birthday.
Okay.
When Mel Blanc died, Mel Blanc, who was the voice of Porky Pig, Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and many other characters from Looney Tunes, they put on his tombstone the phrase, "That's all, folks."
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I think I've seen that before.
I feel like I've heard that too.
Yeah.
Mel Blanc, he was great.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say, though, the people that they have doing the voices now, like,
they sound exactly like
they
him.
They did a great job. They sound really good.
Yeah.
Whoever does a great job. And then Saturday, July, but you can tell. You can still tell.
It's a little bit,
him.
Yeah. You it's not
tell.
Authentic.
It's just not quite him. Then Saturday, July 15th, 1989, Simply Red takes over the top spot in the charts. Again, remember we talked about Simply Red
before?
Yeah,
and I can't remember which one.
If you don't know me by now. I didn't know he redid that song. It was originally a 1972 R&B song.
Was it?
By.
I could see that.
You know who sang that originally?
No.
I don't think I know this version. I listened to it, I didn't recognize it. I only know the original. By Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
Oh, okay.
If you, like, it sounds like a Motown song.
It does. That's why I said I could see that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was originally written for Patti LaBelle, but they never recorded it.
Okay.
So, boom, there you go.
Yep.
Did you know that Patti LaBelle is, like, a huge gay icon?
Yeah.
Gay guys love Patti LaBelle. I didn't know that. I just recently found that out.
Yep.
Well, good for her. Good for gay guys.
Good for everybody.
Gay guys are great. They figure out what's great.
They do. They know the truth.
You know what? I think that we should just give over the Congress and the Senate and everything to gay guys for a while.
That would be my dream.
Wouldn't that be great?
That would be my dream country.
Hey, we're going to make it fabulous.
Oh, my God. It would be my dream.
All of it. Like, can you imagine how great the world would be?
It would be like RuPaul's Drag Race. It'd be all this infighting and bitching and going on in the back.
But, yeah, but overall, they'd come together and run everything great.
That's
maybe.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. We should try that.
We should.
The thing is, it already is. It already is. They're just all closeted.
That's right. So on the Republican side, at least.
Yeah, they're all, like, in bathrooms in airports.
That's right.
And then on Friday, July 21st, 1989, mm-hmm. the famous quote from this movie was, "I'll have what she's having."
When Harry met Sally.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the orgasm scene.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And I got to say, I used to watch that scene over and over.
You did?
No, I didn't.
That'd be a little weird.
But I might start now. No, it was weird. Meg Ryan is like squeaky clean.
Yeah, she is.
Meg Ryan, I wonder what she's up to now.
I think she had, I don't know. I thought she had problems.
She might have. I don't know. She might have not had
She looks, does not look good. She got way too much plastic surgery.
Oh, plastic surgery.
Yeah.
See, that's what society puts all that pressure on.
Yeah,
actresses.
She looks.
Like they have to look perfect.
She looks bad.
She was always looked very young, so now she might look, poor thing.
Yeah.
On that same day that I'll Have What She's Having mm-hmm. came out, Fab Morvan and Rob Pilatus were talked about. Fab Morvan and Rob Pilatus were Milli Vanilli.
Yes.
Well, so we thought.
Mm-hmm.
Beth McCarthy Miller, then an executive with MTV, said the duo's poor English language skills when they came in for their first interview with the channel stirred doubts among those present as to whether they had sung on their records. The first public sign that the group was lip-syncing came on July 21st, 1989, during a live performance on MTV
yep.
at the Lake Compounds Theme Park in Bristol, Connecticut.
Didn't it start skipping or something?
As they performed the recording of the song, "Girl, You Know It's True," mm-hmm. jammed and began to skip, repeatedly playing the partial line, "Girl, You Know It's, Girl, You Know It's,
oh my
Girl,
God.
You Know It's," through the speakers. And they had video of this. I remember seeing that.
I remember seeing it, too. They just stop or something,
they
continue
to pretend to sing and dance on stage for a few moments. Then they both ran off stage. According to the episode of VH1's Behind the Music, which profiled Milli Vanilli, Downtown Julie Brown stated that fans attending the concert seemed neither to care or to even notice. And the concert continued as if nothing unusual had happened. In a March 1990 issue of Time magazine, Pilatus was quoted...
That's funny. The fans didn't even...
They didn't even know. They thought it was just on purpose or whatever it was. They didn't know.
Idiots.
You know, because they were trying to remix stuff.
Yeah.
They probably thought it was just a dance remix or something. Pilatus was quoted proclaiming himself to be the new Elvis shortly after... In March 1990, issue of Time magazine, Pilatus was quoted proclaiming himself to be the new Elvis.
Who was quoted?
One of the two guys. Fab and Rob. So Rob said... I'm the new Elvis, basically. Like,
and this was
so
after
hot.
that MTV thing happened?
Yeah, because they didn't...
Nobody caught it.
Like, that was in 89. And then by March of 90, he was like, we're so big, we can do whatever we want.
We're the new Elvis.
And he also said, he explained that because we're the new Elvis. Like, we're so good and talented, we are more talented than Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, and Mick Jagger.
What?
Yep. And
what an idiot.
And that is... I'm not sure if it comes up later, but that is what, that quote is what made,
piss people off.
No, the guy who really sang the songs.
Oh.
That's what made him like say, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
And he told people, he came out and told people that, hey, they're a sham. We really sing that. You know, that's why he did it. And then he was paid by the producer money, like $150,000. Like, hey, shut up.
Stop
telling people we need this to be big or whatever. And he took that money and he stopped. And then I think later he came out again. And then finally it all blew up and they all discovered it. But
so I
always thought it was just that skipping at the concert.
Yeah, too.
And then it uncovered it.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's not what happened. It was that guy being all full of himself and then the real guy coming out and telling everyone.
Yeah.
But then afterwards, I read up all on this. I was like, I didn't know.
Yeah, I know.
You know, so then Robin Fab put out an album like 2 years later of really them.
Oh, and they called it Robin Fab or something, didn't they?
I think it's called Robin Fab was their group. And I looked it up online and it is. It actually got pretty good reviews, but it's terrible.
It really?
Like it's them singing and dancing and rapping. And the one guy only does a little bit of it. The first guy, I don't remember which one's Robin, which one's Fab. But it's bad. And it clearly, you can tell they have really thick German accents or whatever.
Yeah.
Like they can barely sing in English. Like it's,
oh, my God.
It's awful. It's very shitty. But I will say, so one of them ended up dying.
He did?
He overdosed, drug overdose or killing himself or some kind of thing. The other one, they both, I think, had drug problems. And, you know, horrible problems in one way. But the other one that lived later put out an album in like somewhat recent, like 2012 or something or 10. And that actually doesn't sound, I'm not saying it's good, but it sounds more like mainstream pop music. Like it kind of,
I
could see it being a hit and I would know it was,
yeah.
I was like, oh my God, unbelievably bad like Robin Fab was.
Okay.
There you go. That's way too much information about Milli Vanilli.
It is a lot. You really did some research.
I fell in a wormhole. You know how you like,
rabbit
hole. You're fascinated by something? Yeah. A rabbit hole. I guess I was called a wormhole for some reason. But you get fascinated by something like, oh my God, I forgot that whole thing happened.
Yeah, that's right.
What happened again? And I just remember middle school girls loving Milli Vanilli and having their shirts and whatever. But
yep. You can wear them ironically now.
Did you have a Milli Vanilli t-shirt?
No.
Saturday, July 22nd, 1989, the day after Milli Vanilli had that snafu, Martika took over the Billboard charts.
I don't even remember that.
With Toy Soldiers.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
I can't even sing it other than that Toy
Soldiers.
Yeah,
we don't need to.
Da, da, da. You know who Martika is?
No.
She was from Kids Incorporated.
Oh, really?
Did you
really
ever see that show on Disney Channel? I think it was on Disney Channel.
No, I don't think there was a Disney Channel in 89.
No, there was. There was. It was like on, you had to pay for it, though. Like, but sometimes cable would give you free things. So we watched Kids Incorporated every once in a while. It was terrible.
Okay.
It was like Barney, but with pop songs and a little bit older kids.
Yeah.
And they could all sing and everything, but it was just cheesy. Like, it was just, anyway. So she was on that show. She was, like, the hot girl on that show or something. You don't remember Kids Incorporated?
No.
Kids Incorporated, K-I-D-S.
I don't know.
Does that sound familiar at all?
No.
It was, like, kids in a rock band or something. Or,
I mean, I was 16 in 89.
Yeah, so you were too big, too cool for that.
Too big.
Too big. You're still playing with dolls, though. Yeah. Wednesday, August 2nd, 1989, Parenthood came out.
Yeah.
That was the ninth top-grossing movie of 1989.
I remember that.
Martha Plimpton plays the older sister of Joaquin Phoenix, a.k.a. Leaf Phoenix.
Yeah.
In real life, she dated his older brother, River, for nearly 5 years. Did you know that?
I think I did know that.
And during filming of Parenthood, the cast became obsessed with playing the murder game. It's a game in which one person who is the murderer has to find a subtle way to kill other players.
Oh, we played that at Huron.
Simply by looking at them without giving themselves away as the murderer. And apparently this is very apparent in the dinner scene where everyone is sitting around a table. If you watch everyone's eye movements, it's obvious they're playing that game.
Really?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Isn't that funny?
No, we played that at Huron.
Yeah.
Remember?
It was Assassin.
Assassin.
That's different.
But I think it's the same thing.
No, that one sounds like it's one person the murderer. Like, isn't Assassin like everybody gets somebody's name until you kill.
Oh, that's right.
It's
a little different, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's the same type of thing.
Yeah.
Which is why I probably included it.
Okay.
Saturday, August 5th, 1989. The new number one song that I completely forgot about on the Billboard charts.
Okay.
Prince.
Yeah.
Bat Dance.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Bat Dance? Bat Dance.
Yeah, I kind of remember it now that you say that.
I watched
the Batman movie.
Yeah, I watched the whole video, and Prince is a mix between Two-Face and the Joker and Batman. But
Really?
Got two faces. Half of him is Batman, I think. And the other half is the Joker, and he's dancing. It's like a huge, long, epic musical video. Like,
really? For that song? It's
for that song, Bat Dance. And that was number one on the radio. Like,
I know.
Who would be listening to that? Because there's not a lot of words and stuff to it.
Right.
It's just the Batman theme. But it's really weird. I don't know.
It is weird.
I forgot it even existed. So I'm going to start listening to that all the time.
Are you? Okay, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Prince.
Prince.
Prince did Bat Dance. I didn't remember that happened. Bat Dance.
All right, what's next?
And then Bat Dance came out again, and then we're going to talk more about
Bat
Dance.
No, we're not going to talk anymore
about
Bat Dance.
In more Bat Dance news, Saturday, August 12th, 1989, Richard Marx, one more time.
You're kidding.
One more time. Richard Marx had
three
Billboard hits.
In 1989?
How was he number one? He's such a terrible.
The last one was 89, too, wasn't it?
I think so.
So it was.
Or was it 88? I can't remember. He was.
It
terrible.
Was just one year, one album, probably.
How was Richard Marx?
It's probably on the same album that the only album he ever did.
What is wrong with America?
Yeah, I know.
This makes me sad to be an American.
What's this one called?
Oh my God, I am ashamed of America today.
What?
Right here waiting.
I'll be right here waiting for you.
Wherever you go,
I'll be. Is that right?
I think that's a different song. We'll be right here waiting for you. Wherever you go, whatever you do, I'll be right here waiting for you.
No, that's you're right. Those are two different songs. That's right.
That's a different song. Right here waiting.
We'll be right here waiting for you.
He wrote this as a love song to his wife, Cynthia Rhodes, who he was on the road, and I'll try to find it because I don't think it was that one.
I know it now.
You do?
Yeah. It's almost exactly like that other one, though.
It is?
Yeah.
Who cares? Who really cares? Anyway, he wrote about his wife, and they later got divorced.
Oh,
but she
bummer.
She played Tina Tech in Flashdance.
I don't know.
Do you know who that is?
I can't remember.
Jackie in Staying Alive and Penny in Dirty Dancing, which I don't know any of those parts or who that is. But anyway, they got divorced.
Okay. August 18th, 1989.
Drew Connolly's birthday.
It was Drew Connolly's birthday, and Eric and Lyle Menendez purchased shotguns at a Big Five sporting goods chain store in San Diego.
Wait a minute. How many shotguns?
I don't know. They just
purchased. You just said five.
No, at Big Five sporting goods chain store. Try to listen.
Sorry. They purchased those shotguns the same time that Mandy Patinkin and B.B. King were on David Letterman?
Yes. And that was over 100 miles away from the family's mansion in Beverly Hills.
Wait, they bought those guns the same day that Bucky Dent replaced Dallas Green as a New York Yankees manager?
Yes. Then on August 19th, their parents chartered a yacht and took them shark fishing.
They took the kids shark fishing?
Mm-hmm.
The same day that 13 East was on NBC,
mm-hmm.
starring plump and personable character actress Diana Alice Bellamy?
Okay. Then on August 20th, they burst into the den of their home and discharged 15 shots into their parents while the couple was watching television on the couch. Eric said that he fired first, but in the end, Lyle fired best. He landed the bullet in the back of Jose's head and shot the fatal blow into Kitty's face.
Wait a minute. The day after their parents lovingly took them shark fishing, they shot and killed them?
Yep. Then the brothers...
Wait, they killed them the same day that Saved by the Bell was on? And the particular episode was Dancing to the Max, where there was a dance contest?
Mm-hmm.
And Screech and Lisa won it?
Yes. Then the brothers, who were 21 and 18 at the time, drove to a movie theater and bought tickets for Batman. They tossed the guns and changed into clean, unbloodied clothes before driving back to their house and pretending to discover the scene all over again. Lyle's hysterical whine of, "Someone killed our parents," and his 911 call would later be made fun of in a Jim Carrey movie.
Really?
I'm not sure which one, though. I couldn't figure that out.
I don't remember that part.
Yeah.
Do you think they were listening to Bat Dance on the way to the
movie? They could have been. Now, I got a lot of my research from, there's two really good Vanity Fair articles by Dominic Dunn, who is a crime reporter. He's a defense attorney, I think.
Dominic Dunn. That sounds familiar, but I don't think I would know who that is.
Yeah.
So, wait a minute. So, do you think when they were in the movie, like, they couldn't have enjoyed the movie, right? They had to be just replaying in their head what just happened the whole time.
Yeah.
But we're sure that's what happened? The jury is completely...
And
like,
we'll get into it. So let's look at who the parents were. Jose Menendez was Eric and Lyle's
dad. That's the
dad.
Okay.
He was a Cuban immigrant.
Okay.
He had come from, you know, took a boat here, and he started penniless, and he climbed his way up to the top kind of thing.
Okay.
He was chief executive officer of Live Entertainment, which was a video distribution company that owns Corelco Pictures, which is a movie production company.
Okay.
So he was highly regarded by both his company and his parent company, but he was also deeply despised by nearly everyone who worked for him.
Huh.
So
he was deeply despised by everyone for work for him.
Yeah.
And so he pulled himself up by the bootstraps, but to do it, he had to step on some people, probably.
Yep. And so at the time of the murder, there was speculation at Live that any one of several executives there had reason to commit them.
Well, because that, you know, he was probably taught that's how you get by in the USA.
Well,
you listen to Richard Marx and you step on people.
That's right. Well, he loved to humiliate people in meetings in front of their coworkers.
Really?
He loved to fire people. He loved to threaten to deprive people of their Christmas bonuses a few days before Christmas.
Really? So he's an asshole.
Yeah. His own bonus that year he was blown away by Sons, would have been $850,000.
His bonus?
Bonus.
His bonus was $850,000.
Yep.
Holy so, crap. What business was he in? Oh, he's a video game. You just said video.
No, movie.
Production company.
Yeah.
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 Film production.
So he also had a mistress for 8 years, and he had a family motto.
Well, now, hold on. This is where I stop here. If your bonus is $850,000, that's just your bonus?
What are you talking about? So you would have a mistress if that was your bonus?
Well, the mistress just obviously just comes along with
that,
right?
No, it does not.
Name one person who gets a bonus that high that doesn't have
a mistress.
I don't
even know anybody that gets a bonus that high.
Exactly my point.
All right. So
it's a different world. We can't even imagine what life like
is. He had a family motto that he instilled in his sons that was basically cheat, steal, lie, win.
You know, that's not far off from Jesse the Body Ventura's... His words to live by are win if you can, lose if you must, but always cheat.
Really?
Yeah. So
okay.
Just like Jesse the Body.
So the boys became avid tennis players, and the father pushed.
Nobody likes tennis players.
And the father pushed him into sports that didn't require teamwork, so it was easier to fuck people over to prepare them for the business world.
What? Holy crap. So this guy's a total asshole.
Yeah. So there's not much known about the mom, Kitty. Was her name.
She probably was just an enabler, went along with everything.
She was a former beauty queen, 6 years Jose's senior.
Oh, older than him, huh?
Yeah.
This is starting to sound a lot like you and I.
She had told her therapist at one point before the murders that she was worried that her sons were sociopaths. So that was a clue.
Really?
Lyle and Eric were the typical rich kid bullies, but they weren't really popular.
Huh.
So they were just rich.
Yeah.
And they would bully other people. Lyle was definitely the dominant brother. He was the older one.
Uh-huh.
And he was being groomed to take his father's place in the business.
Even that young? They were in high school, right?
Mm-hmm. Eric was overly sensitive and weak and prone to crying.
That sounds like me.
Now, they had a previous issue with the police in 1988. They stole $100,000 in cash and jewels from a safe in the house of one of their friends.
What?
And the dad made Eric take the rap. Since he was a minor, he wouldn't get.
Wait, the dad was in on the heist?
No, no. But when they got caught,
and he knew it was both of them. But he made
Eric
brother.
So
that the other one was squeaky clean
because he was going into college.
Yeah. Oh.
So in 1987, Eric with his friend Craig wrote a screenplay called Friends, where the main character Hamilton Cromwell looked, acted, and talked just like Eric, and the character murders his parents in that screenplay that they
that
wrote.
Sounds like a good screenplay. Like, I would give that the green light. I mean, based on the character's name alone.
I know, right?
I would give that Hamilton Cromwell. I mean, I want to know more about this guy.
So,
Him to be played by Chevy Chase.
That's a good idea. We know the details of these murders because the brothers confessed them all eventually.
They did?
Mm-hmm. But they weren't arrested until half a year after the murders.
That's 6 months.
And they,
sorry.
And they, and
I'm just like my.
In
I'm
the meantime, really they did. They reportedly spent $1 million of their parents' money on parties, travel, and shopping.
After they died, but before they were convicted.
Yes.
Because they, for a while, there was a time.
Yeah.
A big time where people thought they were innocent.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Well, they thought that something. Yeah. That there was a mob hit or something that happened.
Well, it sounds like it's a good. Not that it's a good idea, but they have a... I mean, if his dad's that much of an asshole, people are going to jump right away. There's a lot of people that would want to kill him. Like Mr. Burns, like who shot Mr. Burns? Like
everybody
hated that
him.
Guy. So there's a lot of people that have a
That's
reason
right.
to.
So on August 24th, 1989, the day before his parents' funeral, Lyle dropped over $15,000 on 3 Rolex watches as witnesses and he would later testify.
You mean the same night that Ving Rhames was on The Equalizer?
Yes.
The same night that Pete Rose, following discussions with Commissioner Bart Giamatti, who also is Paul Giamatti's dad, and baseball's attorneys, he voluntarily accepts a spot on baseball's permanently ineligible list.
Yes.
Tantamount to a lifetime ban.
Yes.
even though he really believed that he would get out of it. But that's the same day that happened.
Oh, wow. Okay. So also sitting next to his father's secretary in the limo home from the funeral services, Lyle showed off the leather loafers and says, "Hey, Marcy, who says I couldn't fill my father's shoes?"
Huh.
Then he wondered aloud to another friend in the car how he could obtain tickets to the U.S. Open. So he was obviously not very broken up about it. The brothers moved out of the family's Beverly Hills mansion and stayed in a series of expensive hotels before finally leasing condominiums on the water in Marina Del Rey. Their adjoining apartments had ample room for parties and movie nights with friends. Eric bought a Rolex too and clothes and lost thousands of dollars gambling. He decided to forego attending UCLA and instead hired a tennis coach for $60,000 in a year in hopes of going pro. He practiced up to 10 hours a day and flew to the Middle East to compete.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Just one of them did that.
Eric, the younger one, yeah. So meanwhile, Lyle returns to Princeton.
So there's probably video somewhere of Eric Menendez playing tennis.
Yeah, there probably is. Meanwhile, Lyle returns to Princeton, but he doesn't attend classes. Instead, he focuses on business pursuits and shopping in the New Jersey and New York areas.
That sounds a lot like my college experience. I didn't do much class going.
But there was also a story, like when he first got to Princeton, Lyle realized he walked in and he thought he was supposed to have a private room in the dorms, and there was somebody, they had accidentally given him a roommate, and so he threw this big fit and threw all the roommate's stuff out in the hall and stuff.
That sounds like a dick move.
Yeah.
That's not what I did in college.
So
I also didn't go to Princeton.
Lyle also hired a team of bodyguards to accompany him on his shopping excursions, and he spent $40,000 worth of clothes and a $60,000 Porsche.
Oh, man.
He purchased a popular student restaurant called Chuck's Spring Street Cafe for $550,000.
Wait, he bought the whole restaurant?
Yeah, and renamed it Mr. Buffalo's after its spicy wings. He wanted to turn it into a franchise.
So, okay, that's a stupid Buffalo. Mr. Buffalo's is kind of a dumb name.
Yeah,
although I kind of want some chicken wings right now.
So they dreamed of athletic success, musical success, and financial success, and they were even interested in politics.
Really?
Eric was once quoted as saying, "My brother wants to become president of the U.S. I want to be senator and will be with the people of Cuba. I'm not going to live my life for my father, but I think his dreams are what I want to achieve. I feel he's in me, pushing me," is what he was quoted as saying.
Eric said that?
Mm-hmm. This is all before they were arrested.
Before they were outed.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't spend all that 6 months doing all that stuff.
They did.
They also went to therapy sessions with Dr. Jerome Oziel. And this is where...
Oh, Dr. Oziel.
It's in these sessions where they would eventually... This was their demise.
They would eventually confess?
So the stress of it all was giving Eric an ulcer. So he confessed to his therapist what he and his brother had
the
done.
The stress of it all? Because it didn't sound like he was under a lot of stress.
No, I know, right?
Had a great time.
Yeah, I guess because the police were investigating.
They were still investigating and questioning him. So maybe during those good times, it just looked like good times, but you're really not. You know how they say that?
Yeah.
The life of the party is really deep down inside or just hurting.
Well, the session was taped, and the Oziel's mistress was in the other room, and she overheard the confession and went to the police.
The doctor's mistress overheard it? Because I was going to ask you, isn't it a client?
No, that's how they got around it.
They can't say anything?
Because
she listened to it. Not attorney, but a psychologist. Like, it's supposed to be
privileged.
Confidential.
Yeah, but yeah, that's why. So, Lyle Menendez was arrested on March 8, 1990 in Beverly Hills. Eric was playing tennis in Israel at the time, but came home voluntarily and was arrested on March 11th. Well, Eric had said he got the idea from an NBC miniseries called The Billionaire Boys Club.
Yeah.
And the murders were almost a straight copycat of the plot of this film. They later got a copy of this film, and it was almost exactly what they did.
Like somebody like went to
even
see a movie.
Going to the movies afterwards.
Yeah, they shot somebody. Because that's the main plot. An idea is shoot somebody, go to the movies, and then come back.
Yeah.
Which I feel we've covered that in something else, too. Somebody else.
It was that murder.
Yeah, the Rafe.
It was another one where he murdered his parents. He probably got the idea from this. Yeah, because this was such a big, news.
Yeah, but the Rafe happened before this, right?
No, that was in the 90s.
Oh, it was the 90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
I mean, in theory, the idea is not a bad one. If
you're at the movies, but you can sneak out in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, start the movie, show you have the ticket, make sure you're seen there, wear something ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you can sneak out and sneak back in, that's the crux of it. Yeah. It sounds like the Menendez guys
went afterwards.
They did it and then went.
They did.
The pathologists aren't going to be able to figure it out.
Yep. So, but then it's the case stalls for years. A judge ruled the portions of the tapes of the brothers' therapy sessions admissible as evidence, which their attorneys appealed. The battle for the tapes dragged out for 30 months until the Supreme Court of California intervened. Both boys were indicted on December 7th, 1992.
The same night that Love and War, a comedy about a woman running a bar and restaurant in downtown Chicago, was on, starring Jay Thomas and Joanna Gleason.
And tried separately for murder. The jury in Eric's case deadlocked on January 10th, 1994.
Oh, that's the same day on CBS Dave's World was on, a sitcom about Dave Barry starring Harry Anderson.
Okay.
And also with Shadow Stevens and Meshach Taylor.
The jury in Lyle's case deadlocked 2 weeks later. The judge declared mistrials. It wasn't until April 17th, 1996 that a third and final jury found the brothers guilty together. The whole process took nearly 7 years.
That's insane. So they, yep, all that time, and they weren't in jail all that time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they were?
Oh,
they,
yeah,
were sitting in jail?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Are they still alive?
Well, I'm not done.
Oh.
So the initial case ended in a mistrial because of a convincing and surprising, when it was introduced, argument from the defense. Attorney Leslie Abramson and her team contended that both Lyle and Eric had been molested by their father since childhood.
Okay.
Now, this wasn't introduced into evidence until 10 days before the trial began. It was
so they kept it down in secret and wanted a bombshell thing, right?
Because they had been in prison for 2 years by the time they came up with this.
Huh.
They had already been there for 2 years.
And so, you think they came up with this? This turned out to
not
be,
yeah,
true?
Oh, I mean,
oh, you don't have to raise your voice.
I mean, it's ridiculous. So,
well, how was I to know?
Abramson, their lawyer, she's really well-known defense lawyer.
Oh, so like really rich.
Real good. Yeah. So the brothers, according to her, she helped the boys depict a lifetime of gruesome and relentless sexual assaults, so starting from childhood and continuing into their teens. According to her defense, the brothers finally banded together in the weeks before the murders to confront Jose and tell him they'd go public with the abuse and destroy his reputation if he didn't stop. They feared his retaliation, their legal team argued. They feared for their lives. That's why they bought the guns. The story was impossible to corroborate because the alleged villains were dead, but by the time the brothers opened up about the abuse, the public had been hating them and eating up the spoiled rich boy narrative for years.
Too late.
So in what can only be considered overkill, the defense, in the old blame the victim strategy, has gone to great lengths to assassinate the character of Kitty Menendez, a deeply unhappy woman heartbroken by her husband's infidelity. Having pumped her full of lead, her sons now participate in killing her again as they listen calmly to their lawyers and cousins' descriptions of her as a desperate, demented, drunken, drugged, suicidal woman who harassed her husband's mistress and was also a dangerous driver and a lousy housekeeper. This is Dominic Dunn's writing. According to the defense, there were always dog feces on the floor and ferret feces dropped by the family's pet ferret under the bed in mom and dad's room where Lyle was sent to lie when he was bad. There was also a rabbit, Lyle's rabbit, but the parents didn't like the rabbit and wanted Lyle to get rid of it. One morning, he found it dead in the garbage can. Either mom or dad or both had bashed in its head and because Lyle hadn't gotten rid of it as they had ordered him to.
This is all false.
And that's all what they,
all just lies,
what they said. Yeah. So they were told in court that Lyle, at 14, was still wetting his bed and that his parents would put the soaking, smelly sheets on the breakfast table.
Oh, that's what I do.
They were told that Kitty threatened to poison her family, that she told her sons she hated them, that she could have had a career in broadcasting if she hadn't had them.
Yeah, she's probably right there.
The defense claims that she knew all along that her husband was molesting Eric. You will hear evidence that she never tended to her son while he was throwing up in the bathroom next door to her bedroom after a sexual episode with his father. You will also hear evidence that up to the age of 15, Eric's mother would periodically make her son submit to her physical inspections of his genitals, which she called checking you out, on and on.
Sounds too specific.
They also heard that
that might be real.
They also heard that in a fit of rage with Lyle a week before the killing, she reached over and pulled off the 21-year-old's hairpiece.
Wait, whose hairpiece?
Yeah. So.
Wait, a 21-year-old has a hairpiece?
Yep. And Leslie Abramson would have the people believe that until that moment, Eric never knew that his brother and protector wore a toupee. According to Abramson, the exposure of the wig freed Eric to tell his brother what their father had been doing to him.
Wait. Is all this still fake?
Yeah. No, he's got a toupee.
He really does have
a toupee. He does. He has some kind of...
And the brother didn't know he had a toupee.
That's what they're trying to... They want people to believe.
So they're trying to... So you got Count Barfield over here barfing every time he's molested.
Yeah.
And the mom's checking his junk?
That's what he says.
That's all that's... And the mom's checking his junk, saying, checking your junk to make sure there's no evidence? Well, Count Barfield is barfing
everywhere. I don't know why she's checking him out. I don't know why she would do that.
But the toupee thing's a real thing.
Yes. He really did have a toupee. But how can you... Yeah, he had no hair.
I guess some people go bald early.
Like, he had really, really premature baldness.
Really?
And he had a toupee. But they want people to believe that his brother didn't know that he had a toupee until this fight.
And that was what...
And then that caused him to open up about all this sexual abuse.
I'm bald also. I was barfing every time I was raped.
That's right.
Mom checked my junk out?
Yep. That's what they want us to believe. I just have a little bit more.
But you don't sound convinced.
No, I don't. I'm not convinced. Hold on. I just have a little bit more.
That's all right.
So they were sentenced. And despite the request to be placed in the same prison, the Menendez brothers were separated and are still serving their life sentences miles apart to this day. But
really?
That's actually, I saw on the news, they just got set, put in the same prison. Now they're in the same prison.
They did, really?
Mm-hmm.
Are they in the same gang?
No. Both had gotten married while behind bars, Lyle twice.
What?
His first wife was a former model. His current wife, Rebecca Sneed, is a magazine editor turned attorney. Eric married Tammy Sackerman, an attractive blonde with whom he'd been engaging letters for 6 years.
Who are these people?
I don't know. That is a good fucking question.
I marry these guys, and why?
And so that is the sordid tale of the Menendez brothers.
I think our next season, we just need to do a whole new podcast on these women who marry crazy criminals.
Well, then we find out men do it, too.
Well, yeah. Well, everybody does it. These are beautiful people that could offer the world lots of things, but
the
they're
criminals?
Spending all their time with criminals.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the criminals
were
beautiful
people.
No, the people
who are marrying them, probably. I mean, you said one was a former model and one was a beautiful blonde.
I know. Like, but then they go and they marry criminals. I mean, Charles Manson had a 24-year-old wife
He died. It's got to be a disorder, something about either fame or notoriety or being obsessed. Something with having someone caged. They need to be locked
that
up.
Or you feel like you can save them. Like you feel like you can find the real humanity inside, and like it's a project. Yeah.
Well, and they can't go anywhere. They're not going to cheat on you.
That's right.
Except with other dudes.
Ooh, yeah, that's true.
When somebody drops a soap.
Yeah, that's true. So that was the Menendez case. You think that was all right?
That was good. Yeah, that's actually definitely way more than because I never paid attention to any of those shows ever. I was just like, I don't care about this. I really paid no attention to any of that. So I was surprised by all that.
Okay, good.
That was good. I think it was interesting. And then on Friday, September 1st, a Michigan farmer named Robert Reed found a camera attached to balloons in his field.
Was it that lawn chair Larry?
No, it was balloons and a camera, not a chair with a guy drinking a bunch of beers.
Okay.
It was a camera attached to balloons. He found it in his field, and he got the film developed, and it contained images of what appeared to be a mutilated corpse.
Tell me everything.
Sparkling, a year-long FBI investigation.
Did you say sparkling a year-long?
I did say sparkling. I don't know why. It's sparking. I don't know why. I can't see. I got glasses. Anyway, it contained images of what appeared to be a mutilated corpse, sparking a year-long FBI investigation.
Okay.
This is where they investigated, and it turned out to be footage for Nine Inch Nails' first music video.
Ugh.
Down in it, filmed 200 miles away.
Oh.
So disappointing, isn't it?
Yes.
So... 1 month before Nine Inch Nails released their critically acclaimed 1989 debut album, Pretty Hate Machine, Trent Reznor and company made their way to Chicago's North Side to film a music video for its lead single, Down In It. The premise was simple enough. A man, played by Trent Reznor, climbed to the top of a tall building only to slip and fall to his death. And the video, so they show him walking up these steps in a building in a city, with a lot of buildings. The video ends with Nine Inch Nails members Richard Patrick and Chris Verena discovering Reznor's dead body days later. To create the illusion of decay, Reznor was covered in cornstarch and cameras tied to balloons were filmed. They filmed overhead views. However, one of those cameras ended up breaking away during shooting and drifted all the way from Chicago to Burr Oak, Michigan, where it was discovered by a farmer.
Oh, my God.
Upon seeing its gory contents, he called the police, who then called the FBI, who then launched a nationwide investigation under the assumption that the man featured in the video was actually dead, and what they were watching was a snuff film.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
Isn't that a crazy thing?
Yes, it is.
So I watched the whole video, and it's clearly, I could see how you would be.
You think it's real?
Out. Yeah. I mean, well, not the video because they've made it like rock and roll. Yeah. Or whatever. But you could tell. You can kind of gather what the must have been on the footage. Yeah. Just the balloons, you know.
Cause yeah. Because the higher up
edit,
pictures.
Yeah. They didn't edit any of that. But can you believe the balloons made it all the way from Chicago? That's all crazy. The way over, all across the.
I wonder what kind of balloons.
It must have been.
How did they control them and let and have them? How did the rest of the balloons, were they controlled?
Well, they didn't control them very good. They
no.
lost one of them. Who knows?
That's nuts.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's a good story.
That's pretty funny. You were surprised.
I used to like that that album a lot.
Nine Inch Nails? I never cared for them.
I used to like them.
It's not very good. If you listen to it now.
It doesn't hold up at all, right? I don't think.
And then the very next day that the farmer found that, he was probably, that same farmer was probably listening to Paula Abdul.
Could be.
She took over the Billboard charts with her first number one.
I don't know.
I think it's her first number one. Maybe it's not. Cold Hearted.
Cold Hearted Snake.
You're a cold hearted snake.
Look into his eyes.
You remember the video for this?
Mm-mm.
I watched that too because I just got done with the Trent Reznor thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Paula Abdul is dancing for these stuffy music executives. And she's got a whole group of team of dancers. And basically, the dancers are basically having sex with each other. There's just tons of sexual positions.
Oh, really?
Humping each other and spreading legs and putting faces and crotches and stuff.
Oh, my.
And then at the end, she's like, oh, what'd you think? And they're like, it was great. And they seem all scared and covered
like
in jizz.
You have boners?
But the video was directed by David Fincher.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know who David Fincher is?
It sounds kind of familiar.
He directed Seven, Fight Club. Those kind of movies?
Yeah.
I don't know. Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
Alien 3.
Okay. I do know
that. That's David Fincher. He directed a Paula Abdul video. That's embarrassing. That was a resume. Saturday, September 9th, 1989. Mm-hmm. New Kids on the Block take over with probably their most well-known song.
What is it?
Hangin'
Tough. Oh, God. I was never a New Kids. I was too old for
Thank
New Kids.
Thank goodness. That's why I love you.
Because I was 16.
I watched this video. I remember, you know, of course. We hated the New Kids on the Block. But I watched this whole video, this whole song.
Yeah.
Honestly, this song makes me embarrassed to be a white person.
Really?
That's a lot of white guilt watching that. Like, just white people trying to be...
Tough
and weird. I mean, the whole song is just terrible.
Do they try to act tough?
They try to act tough, but they're wearing stupid clothes.
Yeah.
Stupid, trendy 80s clothes.
And they're like...
They look like total douchebags. And girls are screaming, crying like they did for the Beatles.
Yeah, they
did. They were like screaming, like crying like they did the Beatles. For these douchebags.
Yeah.
Total douchebags. I mean, there's no part of them that's not douchebaggy.
Right.
There's not one thing about that video that's not complete douchebaggery.
Like, yeah.
It is
total.
The whole thing is the worst thing ever. And they're awful. And I'm embarrassed. To be white. Like,
yeah.
They've shamed the entire white race.
Not hard to do.
Well, you know what? I'll go further. They shamed the entire human race.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to be a human.
Okay.
They're terrible.
How do you really feel?
Oh, God. They're awful. No wonder people don't like white people because of that.
Yeah.
Trust
them
me.
And Phil Collins.
No, Phil Collins is great. Saturday, September 16th, 1989, Gloria Estefan took over the Billboard charts. Don't want to lose you now. It's a ballad.
I don't want to lose you. I don't know.
Can you think of
it? I don't know it at all.
Do you want me to
No.
Sing it? You want me to keep
no,
singing
cause
it?
No, because I can't tell.
Don't want to lose
Stop
you
it.
Now.
I can't tell.
Don't want to lose. Never going to give you
Everything turns into that.
Never gonna
it's a Rickroll.
I think that's how it went. Don't want to lose you.
I think we should start just Rickrolling people in conversations we're having with them. Just start like,
hey, I got some bad news, buddy.
Never going to give you up.
Never going to lose you.
Just start Rickrolling people in person.
Sorry, we had to call this special meeting. And we're going to have to let you go. Don't want to give you up. No, you're really fired, but don't want to let you know.
I think we should totally start doing that.
We should,
And just say, I Rickrolled you.
Live Rickrolling.
You've been
Rickrolled you, motherfucker! And then you walk away.
Live Rickrolling.
I'm going to start Rickrolling people in the neighborhood. help! Put ketchup all over you like you're, I've been hurt, I've been shot. Can you help me?
Stand up. Never going to give
I'll
you.
I'll call 911. Never going to give you up. Never going to let you down. That's a great idea.
Yep.
In fact, let's stop this podcast and start live Rickrolling people. Sunday, September 17th, 1989, after winning a record 4 consecutive Emmys for his role on Night Court, John Larroquette asked not to be considered in 1989.
Oh.
He said, I've won enough Emmys. Stop giving them to me.
Wow.
Yep.
Rare.
And I think he hosted the Emmys too that night.
Okay.
And then Saturday, September 23rd, 1989, we got another new number one song.
Yeah.
Milli Vanilli again.
Oh, something about the Blame It on the Rain.
No, this one's called Girl, I'm Gonna Miss You.
Girl, I'm Gonna Miss You. I don't know.
Girl, I'm Gonna Miss You.
I think it sounds just like the other one.
It probably does. Milli Vanilli sucks. Yeah. Obviously, it wasn't even them singing. And then Sunday, October 1st, 1989, the AOL Welcome and You've Got Mail sounds were recorded.
Okay.
In 1989 on a cassette deck.
Oh, really?
Elwood Edwards is an American voiceover actor, best known as the voice of the internet service provider AOL.
There was a woman's voice. It was a man's voice?
You've got mail.
It was a man's voice?
It was a guy.
Oh, okay.
Welcome. You've got mail.
That was the guy.
You've got pictures. You've got voicemail. Files done. And goodbye.
Oh,
all
wow.
Recorded in his living room on a cassette deck.
I never had AOL, so I don't know.
You've got mail. I remember hearing that. I mean, the movie.
Yeah, there's a movie about it.
About that guy's voice.
Yep.
And that guy murdered 25 people.
I wish.
Immediately afterwards.
I wish. I would make it such a bad.
I know. You would love that if that guy murdered people. I'm just starting everyone murder people at the end of
just
it.
Just so I'm interested.
We should Rickroll that guy.
Yeah.
Never going to give you mail. Never going to give
all
you
all right.
Sunday, October 7th, 1989. Mm-hmm. Another new number one song, Janet Jackson.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm rushing home to see your smiling face and your warm embrace.
Oh, I miss you much.
Good. Yeah, I miss you much.
I could catch that one.
See, I'm a great singer. That's a black and white video, and all the dancers are asking about her personal life, her new boyfriend, when she walks in. And she says,
she's in a belly shirt.
No, she's wearing fully clothes, she's like, I'll tell you about, hold on a second, I'll tell you about how the date went. Mm-hmm. And then she sings the whole song and does a whole dance routine about miss you much and never gets into it. But the video choreography, there's an extended video for this where there's a whole big chair routine that she does with dancing with a chair. Not to be confused with the Pleasure Principle, where she does the famous chair move where she puts one leg on the top of the chair, one on the bottom.
One on each,
makes it fall down and then keeps going.
Yeah.
That's Pleasure Principle. But this one, there's a whole big chair dance routine where she and four other people just start dancing with chairs for like 20 minutes. And the music stops and they just do this whole chair thing.
Okay.
So that's pretty good. And she was beautiful. She had kind of like lost some of the baby fat and got kind of thinner.
Yeah.
But before she got creepy looking, she looked like a hot Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Yeah, they look they're very similar looking before all the surgery. Even when they started getting some of the surgery.
I'll admit, I started questioning my sexuality when I found her attractive. I was like, maybe I'm gay for Michael Jackson.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Then I started dating dudes.
Yep, you did.
I did. And then I met you, babe.
That's right.
You're the best dude I ever dated. And then Friday, October 13th, 1989, Look Who's Talking came out. You know what? Out of 10 movies, where do you think that ranked that year?
What, third?
Fourth. According to Kirstie Alley's memoir, she fell in love with John Travolta during filming, but she stayed faithful to her husband.
And John Travolta was probably eyeing the
all the dudes.
Yeah.
All the key grips.
I was just trying to think of that.
Yeah.
The best boy.
This was his first major acting role in 5 years. This was like his comeback. The beginning of his comeback.
Yeah. He's pretty much definitely gay.
Oh, yeah. When I looked that up, too, I fell in another one of those rabbit holes online. All these people that, like, for years or something, he's totally gay.
Yeah.
He's been gay the whole time. Everybody knows he's gay.
Like, he's
like, everybody in Hollywood is like, yes, he's gay. He doesn't even hide. He bangs every dude everywhere.
That's right. Yeah.
And Kelly Preston is cool with it.
Yeah, she just is like, whatever.
She's like, who cares? It's an arrangement.
Yep.
Same with Tom Cruise.
Makes you wonder about his son, how his son died.
His son had autism.
I know. But it just makes you wonder, like, I don't know.
Wasn't it a plane crash or something?
I don't remember.
I can't remember. Anyway, Tuesday, October 17th. I don't want to start accusing John Travolta of murder.
Yeah, okay. We won't.
Tuesday, October 17th, 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake struck.
Okay.
You remember this?
No.
It struck at 5:04 p.m. And Game 3 of the World Series was scheduled to start at 5:35 p.m. at Candlestick Park in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands of people were already in the stadium when the quake occurred. Because of the coincidence of timing, it was the first major earthquake in the U.S. ever to be broadcast by live television.
Oh, wow.
Experts credit the timing of the series as a lucky break that prevented a massive loss of life in the region. Key in reducing the loss of life was the fact that many people on both sides of the bay had left work early or were staying late to participate in after-work group viewings and parties, reducing the traffic that would otherwise have been on the collapsed freeways at 5:04 on a Tuesday.
Wow, so the freeways collapsed.
Initial expectations were that hundreds of people had died in the collapse of Interstate 880 in Oakland. The final death toll from that event was 42.
Oh, wow.
But it was rush hour. If it hadn't been for the World Series.
Yeah, it would have been thousands.
A Goodyear blimp that was covering the telecast was used to coordinate emergency efforts. At the time of the earthquake hit, ABC's crew was in the booth as Tim McCarver was presenting a highlights package. The earthquake hit while the video was playing and temporarily knocked the feed out. And just before it was knocked out, Al Michaels could be heard on air saying, "I'll tell you what, we're having an earth," with the feed cutting out just before he finished.
Oh.
Michaels, McCarver, and a third man in the booth, Jim Palmer, grabbed for whatever they could to brace themselves and inadvertently grabbed one another's legs, leaving all three men with thigh bruises.
How do you grab one another's legs?
Well, they fell down in a kind of in a circle jerk. And a lot of people don't know this, but as they were grabbing each other's legs, one thing led to another.
Yep, that's what I was waiting for.
And the power came back on as they were all sucking each other's dicks.
Okay.
And so they had to, like, get their dicks out of each other's
mouths. Okay, and we're done with this. We're done with this.
And now back to the World Series. The audio was restored with Michaels taking over a screen bumper until the video was restored and saying jokingly about how the earthquake jolt was the greatest opening in the history of television, bar none.
All right.
Yep, they all sucked each other off. Okay. And then Saturday, October 28th, 1989, the World Series ended with the Athletics sweeping the Giants in four games. It was the first World Series sweep since 1976.
Okay.
Saturday, November 4th, 1989, Roxette becomes the number one song.
Oh, I can't remember what they sang either.
Listen to Your Heart.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how that goes. Do you?
Listen to Your Heart. I don't know. That's all I know.
That's happy for you. Something like
Listen to your heart. Yeah. It's bad.
The dude who wrote it is one of the band members or something. He wrote it based on a friend of his who was in emotional turmoil, stuck between an old relationship and a new love. I don't know. Who cares? That's stupid.
Yeah,
stupid. November 11th, 1989. Roxette's overtaken by Bad English.
Oh.
You remember Bad English?
Sort of.
So I looked this up because I didn't really remember this. The song sounded kind of familiar. The video is awful.
Yeah.
When I see you smile
I can face the world.
Yes.
Oh.
You remember that song?
I can do anything.
It's
terrible.
It's awful. The guy's got a horrible long mullet hair.
Yeah. It's so 80s.
But the singer looked really familiar to me, so I had to look up who he was. So the lead singer of that is the same guy who sang, "I ain't missing you at all."
Oh, yeah. I can hear
missing
that.
Missing you.
I can totally hear that.
It's the same guy, but he's got a long hair and he's in a rock band now.
Yeah.
Called Bad English.
But I wouldn't call it a rock band. The people that sing When I See You Smile.
No, it doesn't sound like that. But when you look at the video, he's dressed like a rock star. Like he's got a leather jacket and long hair. He looks like Whitesnake.
But he sings that?
But he sings that.
Oh, that's funny.
It's terrible. It's awful.
That is funny.
I'm going to kill someone because of that song.
All right.
You'd probably like me better if I committed a murder.
No.
Wednesday, November 22nd, 1989, the sixth highest grossing movie came out. It's a sequel.
Yeah.
It's a sequel to a movie that rhymes with Fact to the Neuter.
Oh, Back to the Future 2.
Yeah, Back to the Future Part 2.
That's right.
Do you remember the whole thing, the whole hubbub with Crispin Glover about this?
No.
Do you remember anything at all?
Mm-mm. Wait, no, is Back to the Future 2 the future one where they go in the future?
Yeah, they go in the future, and Biff, who's basically Donald Trump,
and
becomes president or whatever. A lot of people call Trump just Biff. they call him Biff from Back to the Future.
Do they?
Yeah. Crispin Glover sued the filmmakers as he had not granted permission to use his likeness in Part 2. But they dressed up a guy with heavy makeup, age makeup, to just look just like him.
Oh, really?
And so he sued because that's my likeness completely.
Yeah.
But it's settled out of court for $765,000 by Universal's insurance company because they didn't want to pay Crispin. And then the Screen Actors Guild subsequently introduced new rules about the illicit use of actors. Basically, Crispin Glover was pissed because that he was getting paid way less than a lot of the other actors.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. And then when he bitched about it, they offered him less. And
oh, so, wow.
And then he said, fuck you, I'm not doing it. And then they used the guy that looked like him, then he sued him kind of thing.
Yeah.
Saturday, November 25th, 1989, Milli Vanilli's back up. This time it's...
Now it's Blame It on the Rain.
Yeah, yeah. So this is where the inserts for the American version of the album explicitly attributed the vocals to Robin Fab, and this is what prompted Charles Shaw to reveal in December 1989 mm-hmm. that he was one of the three actual singers of the album and that Robin Fab were imposters. And this is when Frank Farian, the producer, paid him $150,000 to retract his statements.
So he did?
And he did. So because of all the criticism, all mm-hmm. the people are starting to question it, Robin Fab insisted that they'd be allowed to sing on the next album, so they just like make it all go away.
Yeah. But they were probably so bad.
Yeah, so then all this stuff finally came out, and then they withdrew their American Music Awards. Or no, they didn't. They withdrew their Grammys or whatever, but yeah. not their American Music Awards.
Oh, okay.
But I was thinking about that later. I was like, it's still good. I mean, if people liked it.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
Do they care who sang it?
But they said they were saying they were singing it.
They're saying it was these two guys, but it was really these other guys. It's because they're less attractive.
Well, I think it's just the principle of trickery.
But if you still like the song.
Yeah, you should still like the song, but it's not the right artist.
Do you only like it
because
Robin Fab sang it?
I'm not saying I didn't like it one way or the other. I'm just saying people were mad because it was a trick. Because it was
trickery.
Trickery. It was lies.
These two good-looking guys.
It was all lies.
That's not a guy who's attractive.
Based on lies.
Anyway, many, many lawsuits came up later. At least 27 different lawsuits were filed against them.
From who?
Fans.
No.
Yeah, like, and the big one that won was a fan in Cleveland that said she didn't know it was them. She wants her money back. And then she won. So anybody who bought that album in Cleveland could be part of that lawsuit and they lose money. So then there's more and more lawsuits like that. But months later.
Can you imagine being a fan and suing?
And suing them.
That's so dumb.
Robin Fab, they parodied the scandal in a commercial for Carefree Sugarless Gum. And they began to lip sync to an opera recording. And
I remember that.
You do?
Yeah.
And an announcer asked, as their lips were sinking, how long does the taste of Carefree Sugarfree Gum last? The record began to skip. The announcer answers, until these guys sing for themselves.
Yep, I remember that.
You believe that?
Mm-hmm.
Then they moved to L.A. and they did that album, Robin Fab. And despite fabulous positive reviews from critics, the album failed due to financial problems.
Okay.
And only sold 2,000 copies. But I watch on YouTube. It's terrible.
Yeah.
Rob later served 3 months in jail for assault, vandalism, and attempted robbery. He spent 6 months on a drug rehab charge before returning to Germany. And he died of alcohol and prescription drug overdose at a hotel in Frankfurt on April 2nd, 1998. Rest in Pete, Rob from Milli Vanilli.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you and I need to just start memorializing him.
Yeah.
Every episode. We'll say goodbye to Chuck Berry and rest in peace.
No, we're not going to
Rob from Milli Vanilli. And then December 9th, 1989, Billy Joel took over the number one charts with...
In the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep.
No, you're wrong.
Okay, what is it?
We didn't start the fire.
Oh, right.
Zabba dee ba doo ba da ba dee da boob. Zabba dabba dee be dad. Yep. Zabba ding dang. Ding dang. Fling dang. Chamba chamba ching chamba.
Okay.
It's just a listing of things.
That's right.
Billy Joel got the idea for the song when he had just turned 40. He was in a recording studio and met a friend of Sean Lennon, who had just turned 21, who said, it's a terrible time to be 21. Joel replied to him, yeah, I remember when I was 21. I thought I had an awful time, and we had Vietnam, you know, drug problems and civil rights problems, and everything seemed to be awful. And the friend replied, yeah, 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 but it's different for you. You were a kid in the 50s, and everybody knows nothing happened in the 50s. And then Billy Joel said, wait a minute, didn't you hear about the Korean War, the Suez Canal, and all that stuff? Wednesday, December 13th, Driving Miss Daisy came out.
Yep.
So convinced was she that she would lose out on the Academy Awards that year, Jessica Tandy had a $100 bet with her agent that she wouldn't win the Oscar for Best Actress.
And she won.
When she paid up on Oscar night, she told him it was the best bet she ever lost.
Yep.
And then she went down on him.
No, stop it.
Sunday, December 17th, 1989.
Yeah.
Simpsons roasting on an open fire.
That's a good one.
This is the very first episode of The Simpsons.
I think they get their dog.
Yeah, while Christmas shopping, Bart sneaks off and gets a tattoo. Marchand discovers it, blah, blah, blah. They don't have any money. They lose all their money.
Santa's
getting
little
the
helper.
Tattoo removed, and Santa's little helper shows up. Yep, that's when Simpsons started, 1989.
Yeah, that's a good... That's when it was still good. It's not good anymore. I tried to watch it the other day.
It's not good.
It's just not.
Well, some things just end.
Jump the shark.
They need to end.
Yeah, it needs to end.
And to ruin your good feelings about The Simpsons on December 23rd, 1989, Phil Collins is back.
Oh, God damn it.
Phil Collins has another number one song.
Oh.
This is a song about homeless people. This is a millionaire singing about homeless people and how you should take time and give homeless people money.
What is it?
Another Day in Paradise.
Oh, I remember that.
It's another day for you and me
in paradise.
And the whole video is about people walking past homeless people, ignoring them. And this actually got people up in arms. Like, fuck you, Phil Collins. You make way more money than most people.
Yeah, right.
You give homeless people some money. You dick.
People got mad about him.
Yeah.
Oh, time for toys.
Phil Collins is all I got.
Time for toys.
So we're going to end. We cannot end a whole season.
Wait, I got toys.
On Phil Collins. So please tell me you have something other than just Phil Collins, Another Day in Paradise.
I got toys.
You love
toys,
Phil Collins.
Toys.
You don't want to end on Phil Collins?
No.
With a great taste in your mouth of Phil Collins?
No, no. Okay.
It's
the first toy is the Babysitter's Club book set. That was
the Babysitter's Club. That's still a thing, right?
Kids maybe. Still?
There's like a new version where they have tablets and they twerk. But
probably.
They twerk.
They twerk. Yeah. Another one is the bubble mower, and that was a lawnmower that bubbles would come out
that
of it.
That didn't come out until 1989?
That's what it said.
Huh. I want one of those.
Yep.
You use it for... You can turn that
bubbly
into...
Bubbly grass clippings is what you'll get when you use this mower.
That'd be a cool thing to turn into a bong. Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Sweet.
There was a Double Dare game. Answer questions or take the physical challenges just like the Nickelodeon television game show.
That's supposedly coming back.
Double Dare?
They're bringing Double Dare back, yeah.
Oh, really? There was a Florence Griffith Joyner doll.
Oh.
She was a fashion doll. Her fashion will be hard to catch.
She's the fastest woman, right? With those big, long fingernails?
Yeah, that's right. Fashion, fitness, and fantasy. That's this Olympic star. Comb her hair and dress her up in her complete line of FloJo fashions.
FloJo. That's right, FloJo.
Including nail decals to decorate little girls' nails just like FloJo's and a brush and a tote bag for the doll.
FloJo was fast.
Yep, she was fast. There was a McDonald's uniform.
Oh, he could just...
Yeah, wear the uniform of a real McDonald's employee. Dress up a set of cloth and plastic, includes apron and Velcro straps, cap, microphone, wipe-off name tag, spatula, and tongs.
Grow up to be a fucking loser.
I know, right?
Oh,
let's just
keep it realistic.
I
love McDonald's employees. They're not losers. Come on.
And then the next one is...
I would bang everybody.
This one kind of goes with it. This is a Play-Doh. It came out with a Whopper kit, and it was a... you could make Burger King Whoppers. Yep, with pickles and relish and onions and stuff.
These things like the toy companies were sitting around. How can we capitalize on this fast food market? Fast food's big right now.
That's right.
Okay, you dress like a McDonald's person and we'll have Play-Doh Whoppers.
That's right. What about the Sega Genesis that came out?
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't have one, but I remember it. Maybe I did. Yep. I don't think I did. I don't know.
And the last thing is the Ghostbusters set. Choose from the Ecto Goggles and Ecto Popper, Neutrona Blaster, and Ghost Trap. Or get the Proton Pack, which includes the backpack with straps, Ghost Blaster with soft foam wand, power cord, PKE meter with rotating antenna, Ghostbuster armband, label sheet, and Ghostbuster ID.
Grab the Proton Packs off the back and they split. Find out about Vigo, the master of evil. Try to battle my boys. That's not Lego.
All right.
Sorry, that's Bobby Brown. I think I've had a little bit too much Boonshine.
Okay.
This is a Tropic Pale Ale from Boone, North Carolina.
Is it good? So that was the toys, and that was 1989.
And now we have a correction and apology.
Okay.
Okay, I have a couple corrections and apologies from last episode. First of all, Brian McCartney, thank you. He's very good at pointing out our mistakes. And this isn't one I didn't definitely say this, but I kind of, remember I mentioned oral Hershiser? Oral and anal Hershiser?
Yes, yes.
And I felt like, I said, I feel like he played for the Tigers or something.
I
knew he had a local connection to
the
Northwest Ohio area. And Ryan reminded me, I totally forgot this. He is a Bowling Green Falcon.
Oh.
He went to BGSU. He's like the most famous BGSU guy, maybe besides Tim Conway and Eva Marie Saint.
Okay.
Yeah, so there you go.
Yep.
He was a BGSU Falcon. I can't believe I forgot that.
Okay.
Oral Anal Hershiser, BGSU Falcons. Also, I'm very disappointed in myself for this next one. We talked about Just the 10 of Us, which is one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. And the lead actor was one of the greatest actors in American history, Bill Kirkenbauer.
Okay. That's
and I know it's Bill Kirkenbauer. Bill Kirkenbauer is a funny comedian. I loved him. I've loved Bill Kirkenbauer. I'm a big Bill Kirkenbauer fan. Mm-hmm. Anybody who knows me knows.
All right, but
I'm
enough.
A Bill Kirkenbauer fan.
We get the point.
But in last episode,
you forgot his name.
I called him Dan
Kirkendall.
Kirkendall.
Yep.
And I don't know why.
Well, that's
why
fine.
I would have. And I said it so definitively. Oh, it was Dan Kirkendall. Like, that's not. That's Bill Kirkenbauer.
All right. That's all you need to do.
Right. I know it's all I need to do, but I don't understand why I would have just made up a different name.
Because you're nuts.
That was it for 1989. We have nothing else?
Nothing else for the 80s. That was the 80s.
That was the 80s, and that was our whole season.
That's right.
Season 2 is done. We've done 20-some-odd episodes, 26, 27, 35, okay. Whatever it is. We're now a podcast. We're going to be coming at you soon with Season 3, the 70s.
Can't wait. It's going to be so good.
And so you guys will have to be patient, because if there's any corrections and apologies from this episode, which I'm sure there are.
Yes.
Amy was just fucking flying by the seat of her pants. I probably said some things wrong, because I've been drinking. But we'll be back next season for season 3.
Woo!
The 70s. The 70s.
Crazy.
It's going to be psychedelic. It's going to be a lot of drugs. A lot of disco. A lot of bell bottoms.
Good music in the 70s.
Heroin, right? Was heroin the big thing? Is that right?
I don't know.
A lot of weed. A lot of free love. No, that was pot. 60s. A lot of pot. A lot of like orange kitchens.
Orange and brown.
Everything was orange and brown.
And avocado and gold.
Like huge collars and welcome back Kata.
That's going to be awesome.
It's going to be fun. We're going to have a good time. So hopefully we'll see you back here. Same place. You don't have to do anything different.
Nope.
Stay subscribed. Still give us 18 stars. Still make up fake.
Still rate us, review us, tell your friends.
Yeah, rate us and review us. Keep telling your friends. Bug your friends. Like, shake them until you see them give us 5 stars on iTunes.
Or at least listen.
Or listen.
Yeah.
We love you, and
it's time to get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Yeah, let's say goodbye to season 2, y'all. Season 2 was fun.
All right, take it away, Matt Shirley.
Time Lord.